Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Anthony Wallace. Anthony Wallace is a senior lecturer in the Arts and Science Writing Program at Boston University, where he is co-director of Arts Now, a curriculum-based initiative to support the arts at BU. He has published poetry and short fiction in a number of literary journals, including Cutback, The Atlanta Review, another Chicago magazine, The Florida Review, River Styx, and The Republic of Letters. His new book, entitled The Old Priest, won the Drew Hines Literature Prize, and his title story won a Pushcart Prize and was included in Pushcart 37, the 2013 edition. And we're really happy to have Anthony Wallace here from Boston. Congratulations on winning the Drew Hines.
Thank you.
What a great thing to be here.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're going to start with something from The Old Priest.
Yes, this is the title story of my collection called The Old Priest, and it's a long, short story that comes in 20 parts. I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning and then move into later in the story.
Okay.
The old priest is a Jesuit, brainy and fey. He smokes Pall Malls fixed bayonet style in an onyx and silver cigarette holder and crosses his legs at the knee. He tells stories as if he is being interviewed for a public television special on old priests. A small guttural chuckle serves to launch one of his very interesting anecdotes. It's a kind of punctuation that serves as a transition, like a colon or dash. You bring your latest girl to see the old priest. You always bring your latest girl to see the old priest. Mildred, what are you doing with this rascal? Asked the old priest, ordering a Tanqueray martini standing up. Mildred squeals at the idea of you as a rascal. Everything is very jolly. The old priest's hair is the same shade of silver as the end of a cigarette holder, a prop which fascinates Mildred. This cigarette holder was given to me by the mother of one of my students, explains the old priest. She didn't think priests should smoke non-filtered cigarettes, and she objected to the bit of tobacco that became occasionally lodged in the corner of my mouth. Later that same mother, emboldened by one too many grappas, tried to seduce me in the sitting room of the country house where I was to spend the weekend. Your latest girl is rapt at the stories of the old priest. They are always rapt. The old priest does half the seducing for you. Back in the room, Mildred says, that's some old priest. Is he gay? What do you think? I think all you Catholic schoolboys seem gay. Then we move a bit further on. This story covers a lot of ground time-wise, and so I start the story moving, and we get some repeated episodes of the narrator who's speaking, as you could hear in the second person, moving through time, his own time and also the time of the old priest. Time and again, you meet the old priest. Years fly by the way they used to mark time in the movies. Wind and leaves, the corning tearing of the calendar page, the plangent tolling of time's own iron bell. You either bring a girl along, or if you're depressed, you go by yourself and expect to be consoled. I want to write, but I can't write, you say. It will come, says the old priest. Give it time. But the pattern is that you should have written your first stories by now. You're a bit behind schedule, you know. You can almost convince yourself that he knows what he's talking about. He speaks with the authority of a grammar book and is relentlessly optimistic. And so episodes like that go on for quite some time, and we get an image of the old priest as drinking and smoking and being seen out in public places and fancy restaurants until much later in the story, at which time the narrator has lost touch with the old priest but has written down some of his stories as a way to try to get published. And so he hears from another student of the old priest, whom I refer to as former student X. Life goes on this way, wind and leaves, the corny tearing of the calendar page, until one October afternoon, after explaining to your AP seniors the theological underpinnings of everything that rises must converge, you go to check your email and there is death, exactly where you expected it would be. Salutation. I am sad to inform you Father passed away. He has a viewing this evening in Philadelphia and then a mass tomorrow morning at St. Ignatius Church in Baltimore, and then afterward is being buried at the Woodstock Cemetery, also in Baltimore. I think of you often and gather you are a quite successful writer. Be well, former student X. You write back, describing what you were doing on the day of the old priest passing, the conversation you had with your students about the world of guilt and sorrow, which is a quotation from Flannery O'Connor, just moments before reading of the old priest's death, expressing regret that you were not present and asking the obvious questions. What you really want are the details that will allow you to form a resolution, the resolution that will allow you to close the book. Salutation. The viewing was in Philadelphia at Manresa Hall on Friday, October 27th, a place for old and dying priests. There were about 10 really old priests in walkers and wheelchairs, as well as former student Y and former student Z, and myself from the class of 1982. There was also one gentleman from Gonzaga's class of 1961, who was an architect in Bryn Mawr now, and one other impaired middle-aged man present. I overheard the gentleman with the short leg and hearing aid tell another priest that when he was at Georgetown Prep, he was bullied because of a speech impediment and his limp, and Father helped put an end to it. The day was cloudy, cold, and drizzling wet. After the viewing, he was taken to Baltimore. Father Lemon did the ceremony. I was not there at St. Ignatius Church. Apparently, there is a Woodstock cemetery in Baltimore, and that is where he will be buried. As for not seeing him, no one knew how sick he was. I saw him in mid-September. My wife Susan, I recently got married, and I went to the provincial's house in Baltimore where he was living and took him out for lunch. We showed him our wedding pictures. Of course, he had his cigarettes and martini. He was frail. When I inquired to his health, as I always did, he said, "Not bad for a man my age, don't you think?" In early October, he was sent to Manresa Hall in Philadelphia. They could not care for him at the provincial's house in Baltimore any longer. For the last year, he had been struggling with throat and neck cancer. Yet even his sister and niece, nor anyone close to him, knew until a week or two before he died. He was in Philadelphia, 15 minutes away from me, and I did not even know. His sister remarked that it was typical of the Irish not to talk about illness and dying. That is all she could understand of not knowing, and she would be likely to do the same if she was dying. As for the world of guilt and sorrow, remember Flannery O'Connor also said, "All is sacred, nothing profane." And his father used to quote to me from St. Julian of Norwich, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." Father would not want us to spend any useless time on guilt and sorrow. In the last month, the cancer became extremely aggressive, and he developed a large tumor on his neck and left chin. It was visible, although I did not see it until a month ago. On his last Friday, October 20th, he got up, although hard to eat, and talk at this point, he got dressed. At lunch, went outside to smoke and drink while reading the New York Times. After lunch, he told the head nurse he was going to take a nap. She went in to check on him because that was not typical, and after a time, he appeared to wake up abruptly, got halfway up from the bed, looked her way, collapsed to his side, and died. He went without any pain, quickly doing what he loved, smoking, drinking, and reading. He said to me he thought of death as a perfectly open door with bright light radiating, and that one day he would walk casually through that door. He told me he cared about this life and that he did not care about death because it was completely unknowable. It is particularly strange that you were teaching Flannery O'Connor and the underpinnings of theology. I am sitting here with Father's master's thesis from Louvain, completed April 2, 1954, entitled Prayer and Theology. In it, Father writes, "A book is a machine to think with. In a good book, the statement is verified both for the reader and writer alike. I do not flatter myself that the short paper offers that advantage to any reader it may have. My problem is too personal, as is the solution I have worked out for myself. This paper is nothing more than a machine for thinking out a problem that has long troubled me. It were better compared to a loom upon which I propose to weave some of the unrivaled elements of science, service, and prayer. My problem in its simplest form was this: how to integrate the elements of prayer, theology, and daily routine into a unified whole. Or more exactly, what is the point at which theology can become the living source, the principle of prayer in action? If such a point existed, and I did not for a moment doubt that it did, I wanted to find it and to formulate it as accurately as possible. Because above all, my solution had to be a practical solution. I wanted a principle that would be operative beyond the walls of the theologate, that would prolong not only the effects of our 4 years of study, but would keep theology as the central point of reference from which all flowed and to which all returned, so that no phase of my life as a priest would not know its permeating presence. I think I have found such a principle in that method of theological reasoning we call the argumentum ex convenientia. I look upon the argumentum ex convenientia as the summit of theological reasoning, that towards which all the rest of theology is ultimately oriented, and I find that it is at the same time a form of prayer, a method, if you want to place it in that category, which partakes of the nature of contemplation." Father goes on to say that to highlight one aspect of this interdependence of theology and sanctity is my purpose here. Much of the writing is in French and hence unable to translate it, given my poor skills as a French student. There is another passage I think you would like a few pages on, in which Father talks about eternity as a place that contains everything that has ever been. Every lost dog, as he describes it, every broken watch and burnt dinner, then adds, if eternity really is eternity, then nothing is ever lost. It's all there, for all time, safe and whole within the sight of God. This in itself is the living source that theology describes and that prayer allows us to stand in daily relation to, and which, properly understood, is the source of meaningful action. I have attached a picture of Father a little less than a year before he died, and a wedding picture. I picture Father now at this moment frolicking among the lost dogs and broken watches and burnt dinners of eternity. I hope you are well. Thank you. Your brother through Christ, former student X.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Anthony Wallace. And he just won the Drew Hines Literature Prize for 2013, which is a really wonderful thing. And we're happy to have him here. And he was reading from the title story, The Old Priest. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about what's going on in the story. Not so much content, but the writing of it. Seems like there's a lot of shifting content and quick contradictions in your writing that are not meant to be seamless, you know, and a lot of uncertainty, ambiguity of statement. And can you talk about sort of that method of writing that moves us quickly from here to there and back and can get us off balance and how that comes to pass in your writing?
Well, I think that the narrator is a little off balance because if you look at the cover of my book, it's an illustration of the old priest in shadow holding his cigarette holder and martini glass. And so the image itself is a little incongruous and also done by contrast, because you see the old priest in shadow, but then you see the colored balls that he's throwing into the air. That the colored balls are a reference to an image in the book about how the old priest himself converses and moves around from subject to subject and tells stories. I mean, I think the story itself is about uncertainty and moving around in time and coming to terms with the past, because as we find out here, the old priest has died, but the story still goes on for two more chapters. And so it's about a search of the narrator for what his relationship with the old priest was, what it meant to him, and what finally he should do with it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I like about your stories is that you allow some unpleasantness in, you allow a lot of negative stuff in there, as in the nature of frailty and the nature of corruption with the priests, with other characters in the book, and it seems like no one is protected in that way in your work. And I'm wondering if that idea of the nature of frailty is one that's really important to you as a writer.
What do you mean by frailty?
Frailty, I mean moral frailty. You know, people who have, everyone has contradictions and levels of corruption, but that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's what the story examines, and to a certain extent, that's what all the stories in the collection examine, those darker sides that we all have and that aren't separate from all the other aspects of our personality, that the old priest is in some ways a problem for our narrator because he's so multidimensional and because he has so many sides, including some sides that are very dark. And that's why I finally agreed to the color illustration that U Pittsburgh Press ran by me, or they ran by me three or four selections, and that was the one I finally chose, because you see a kind of mixture of light and dark, and also dark and whimsical. The illustration, I wouldn't like an illustration that was just an old priest in shadow that suggested some kind of pedophilia scandal, which is still something that I think is pretty current when we talk about the Catholic Church. And to some extent, the larger concerns of the story are with the Catholic Church and my upbringing in the Catholic Church. I wanted to get in the other dimensions of right. kindness and caring and light and, you know, martinis and cigarette holders.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's clear. Okay, can you read some more?
I have another passage that relates to what I was just talking about with the Catholic Church, and that the story became longer in part because I began to see it as a meditation on my background in the Catholic Church and how I felt about that as well, and what I might do moving forward about that. And so this is chapter 12. In the Catholic grammar school you attended as a boy, the priests kept themselves at a distance while the nuns ran the show, dour and plentiful in their identical costumes, as if they'd tumble out of a machine that vended them a penny apiece. If a priest came into the classroom on the odd Tuesday afternoon, it was like Jesus Christ Almighty had come down from the cross to tell a few jokes or riddles. One priest was a fanatic for spelling, another asked questions plucked randomly from the Baltimore Catechism. Who made us? God made us. Who is God? God is the supreme being who made all things, and so on. Another priest, an older man, the pastor, came into the classroom a few times a year and claimed to be able to read everyone's thoughts. As he went through the catalog of what all the children were thinking, he threw his arms around and paced violently in the manner of Bishop Sheen. He scared the bejesus out of you, you have to admit. Then, too, that was the whole point. At a certain time of year, the parish priest came to bless the house. You remember your grandmother kneeling down in the cramped living room, her head bowed, the priest intoning the words and sending sprinkles of holy water flying from a small, occult-looking bottle drawn from his inside pocket. You like to remember his black suit, his black hat with its short brim, his small black cigar balanced nimbly on the railing just beyond the open doorway, the priest reeking of cigar smoke and spewing holy water on the dated furniture, your grandmother kneeling on the spinach-colored carpet, kerchiefed head bowed low. Years later, this memory or set of memories was triggered by the climactic scene in The Exorcist, the two priests standing in the room with the possessed girl throwing holy water and chanting, "The power of Christ compels you, the power of Christ compels you." There have been other movies, other movie priests. Pat O'Brien as Father Jerry Connolly, the slum priest who was turned away from a life of crime and Angels with Dirty Faces. Bing Crosby and Barry Fitzgerald in Going My Way. Bing Crosby once again as kindly and melodious Father O'Malley in The Bells of St. Mary's. Spencer Tracy as fighting Father Flanagan in Boys Town. David Niven as the ambitious but unhappy Episcopal bishop in The Bishop's Wife. Helped to deeper level of spirituality by Cary Grant's Angel Dudley. Carl Malden as the two-fisted activist priest and on the waterfront, Oscar Werner as the tormented and dying theologian in The Shoes of the Fisherman, a not very well-known actor as the priest in The Song of Bernadette, who believes Jennifer Jones has had a true vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Rex Harrison as the Pope who commissions the painting of the Sistine Chapel in The Agony and the Ecstasy, Thomas Tryon, before he became a novelist, in The Cardinal, Richard Chamberlain is the priest with the untamable lust in The Thornbirds, Robert De Niro as the priest who tries to play the complicated game of church politics and True Confessions, William S. Burroughs as the junkie priest in Drugstore Cowboy. There should be more priests, more movie priests we have yet to see upon the silver screen. The priest who solicits oral sex in the sacristy, then absolves the altar boy when he is finished with him. Absolvo te, blah, blah, blah. There has never been a language better than Latin when it comes to being an old priest. Mysterious, arcane dripping of the long ago. The cheerful parish priest who lives a decent life, ministers to his flock, likes to treat himself to a good dinner, likes even better to be treated by his well-heeled parishioners. He is affable, physically soft, a guy who knows how to go along to get along. The priest lost in the mysticism of his own religion, sitting alone in his room, chanting gibberish. If he were not a priest, he would be on the street living in a cardboard box. His illness is legitimized, yet who is to say he is not a true mystic? Then, too, who is to say the guy living in the cardboard box is also not a true mystic? The priest who leaves his order and breaks his vows to marry the woman he met working behind the counter in the pizza shop. The priest who leaves his order to marry the nun he met in the grammar school. The priest who leaves his order to marry the priest he met in the seminary, or much later, perhaps, the one who reminds him of that charming young fellow. There was an old woman one time, the grandmother of a high school acquaintance, who said that you should be a priest, you had just the right look. You pretended to wonder what she meant by that. You knew exactly what you meant by that.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Anthony Wallace. He's reading from his collection of stories, The Old Priest, which just won the Drew Hines Literature Prize. OK, Okay. I think you're going to read from a couple other stories, but before you do, I want to ask about, I guess, the focus on story in your stories, about people relating stories within a story and how, you know, even after the priest dies, the story remains. It seems like there's something really important about the idea of story that almost becomes a character in your work.
Yeah, yes, and I think that runs through the entire collection, and some of the other selections that I've chosen for today also have to do with stories and characters within the stories themselves telling other stories.
I know, there's a lot of stories.
There are a lot of stories, because I think that's what we do, and I think the stories my characters choose to tell are what they remember most.
Mm-hmm.
And so, by extension, what our narrator tells us in The Old Priest is what he remembers most about the old priest. That story ultimately defined the old priest, and story was important to him because it was what he was finally passing on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not just to our narrator, but to his other students, a student like former student X, who had also heard those same stories. One of the motifs throughout the old priest is that the old priest not only tells stories, but he repeats his mm-hmm. stories quite a bit. If you want to say abstractly that the collection is about time and memory, I think that's what we do. That is, we don't just remember, but for the most important things, we remember over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And those memories attain a kind of permanence that finally defines our lives.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like reading your stories, it's almost like it becomes a mythology, you know, a mythology of the personal. Even if it's a so-called real story that is repeated, we all know that memory is flawed and the stories change. And if you talk to two people in a family, the same story is very different. So it's kind of interesting how the story is, the idea of story is privileged so much in the book. Among all the flawed characters. So I think there's so many layers to what's going on in the book. I wonder if you could give us a section of another story.
Yes, but I do want to say that I think the word mythology is really important. I was going to use the word eternity, but I think when story becomes eternal, that's exactly the point at which it becomes mythological.
Mm-hmm.
And so the old priest as the central figure, because the story is by far the longest in the collection. It's about 42 pages. It's not quite a novella, but it's a very long, short story. Is at least half a mythological character to the narrator, mm-hmm. and part of that, I think, is by the priest's own doing, that mm-hmm. there's something importantly self-created about him that's at the center of what the story's about and the narrator's meditations on him. For that reason, in the following story, which is called Snow Behind the Door, I have a section in which the narrator's grandmother is old and dying, and these are two stories in a row about old and dying people who are insistently telling stories that are important to them, I think at least in part, so that somebody will listen and maybe take them someplace else. And so the narrator's grandmother's dying. The narrator himself is working a casino job in Atlantic City that he's not happy with, and in his spare time he's looking in on his grandmother, whom he's been very close to. Coffee and Valium between trips to the doctor. High spring now and some sunshine cleft between the damp island days. She worsens in front of me, asks me to stay longer now, and always a little longer. I arrange her in the bed, wait with her the 2 minutes or 2 hours for sleep to come. Her hands always seem to be reaching for me. That was the month of October, she begins. I remember because he died right after that in a sawdust fire at the RCA factory where he was a cabinet maker, a foreman for the craftsman who made the cabinets for Victor talking machines. I should interrupt and say that the grandmother is herself talking about her father, who died in the 1920s in a fire at the Victor talking machines factory in Camden, New Jersey. These are a few things I remember from that night, right before the man from the factory came to tell Mom the news. I remember that we watched while Uncle Cosmo went into the house and then up the lighted stairs. And then later, we walked down the block and past the market and stood outside the house where my uncle and aunt lived. And there was a big fight, and we could hear him yelling in his broken English, "Some damn girls, you believe some little damn girls make up stories. What a house, what a stairs, what a woman." I remember the wooden stalls set up Halfway into the street, the smell of mussels baked with capers and olive oil and breadcrumbs, the way that man looked on the pavement as he turned his back to us. Another time, Pop brought home a sack of oysters, and he sat on his wooden bench in the kitchen shucking them, and he put out sliced lemons and some ketchup. I can still taste the seawater as it rolled out of the shell onto my tongue, and I've never tasted anything as wonderful again. That's the last time I can remember Pop eating with us, and my brother Jack was late coming in. He used to play pinochle with some friends of his in a room back behind Goldstein's funeral parlor, and Pop threw a fit about it, his lateness that is, not the fact that he'd been playing pinochle in a mortuary. He turned the table with the oysters and all the condiments over in front of Jack, and Jack told Pop that it was his dinner and he could do it with it, whatever he liked. He wasn't spiting anybody but himself. That made Pop even madder, and he threw Jack out that night. I remember Mom crying over it and all the oysters in their shells scattered on the brick floor of the kitchen and Mom sweeping them up with a straw broom. That was the last time Jack saw my father, and he always talked about it afterward. A week later, they came in, two men I think it was now, from the RCA factory in Camden, and gave Mom the news. She couldn't understand all of it because her English was very poor, but in a little while I came home from the movies. It was Saturday and I had gone to see The Phantom of the Opera with my cousins. I came into the house and the man told me I had to tell Mom in Italian what he was saying, and he had a check and she had to sign the paper, then get right to it. She signed and I was crying, and everybody as they came in and got closer to dinner found out they were crying, except for my brother Jack, who wasn't there because Pop had thrown him out. I had a brother Joe too, who wasn't living with us because he was a deaf mute and hard to control. Some relatives in Atlantic City were taking care of him for us because they had no children, and we were nine, counting Babe, who my mother was pregnant with, and that day the two men came with the news and the paper to sign. After the money ran out and we couldn't give the family in Atlantic City anything toward keeping Joe, they sent him back to us. He was about 16. He was working laying mosaics in a church they were building. He didn't want to come back with us, and he didn't want to leave his job making beautiful pictures of saints and angels, and he didn't want to go away from the ocean. These things he told me in sign language. Then when he found out Pop was dead, we couldn't control him. I was the only one who could understand him even a little. We had French doors in that house, one in every doorway of every room, and Joe lost his temper and kept trying to tell us something, and I remember everyone asking, "What's he saying? What's he saying?" He broke every window in the house that night, and finally the police came and took him away, and we never saw him again. November, misi rimorti, rare, porta anivi, my mother said when she was gone, and crossed herself and went into her bedroom to light three candles because the following day was All Souls. November, month of the dead, snow behind the door.
It's the writing of Anthony Wallace, and he's reading from his book, The Old Priest, which just won the Drew Hines Literature Prize from the University of Pittsburgh Press. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was great. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.